Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Thank you for listening to my 25th episode. I'd like to start off with an article from The Prospect, "The Junk Food President Aims to Ruin American Nutrition." This is a rather long article, but it's an excellent overview of our development of the nation's dietary guidelines and the intractable corporate influence, particularly in the Trump administration. So here goes. President Trump welcomed the college football national champion Clemson Tigers to the White House in January with a fast food feast served buffet style in the state dining room. Presidents do not directly write the nation's dietary guidelines for Americans, which are updated every 5 years by federal law. Still, you wonder what the 2020 version will advise, given how President Trump serves lunch dripping in saturated fat, grease, and salt to top athletes. When Trump hosted Clemson University's National Collegiate Football title team in January, the government was in partial shutdown, so a meal could not be catered by White House staff. Trump feigned to the team that perhaps First Lady Melania Trump and Second Lady Karen Pence would have made them, quote, some quick salads. Trump then joked, "I said you guys aren't into salads." Instead, Trump ordered from the four food groups that were the staples of his 2016 election campaign: McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, pizza, and Diet Coke. He boasted to the Clemson players that he ordered 1,000 hamburgers. "All American companies," he said. "Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's. We have Big Macs. We have quarter pounders with cheese. We have everything that I like, that you like. And I know no matter what we did, there's nothing you could have that's better than that, right?" There was plenty of laughter from the football teams, perhaps to be polite and perhaps because they actually eat much better than that on campus. The team receives far more nutrition education than the average American, from culinary coaches and an executive performance chef. In a nation where two-thirds of adults and a third of children are overweight or obese, Trump's banquet really wasn't funny. According to the 2015 guidelines that are currently in force, poor diet and lack of exercise are likely related to preventable chronic disease in nearly 120 million American adults, including type 2 diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and cancer. The direct and indirect costs in medical care and lost work time, not to mention sheer suffering, run hundreds of billions of dollars. Ordinary Americans, especially the disadvantaged, live in a separate universe from Clemson's performance chefs. Most parents want to be good quarterbacks for their children, but too often they are sacked by an all-out marketing blitz of junk food, processed food, and sugary drink companies. With a fast food president as dietitian-in-chief, those special interests surely see the best opportunity in recent memory to undermine the healthiest of science-based recommendations. If they have it their way, the symbol of the all-American diet will remain a Big Mac, Coke, and fries. Even under the public-minded Obama administration, the political food fight over the 2015 guidelines is instructive. With First Lady Michelle Obama promoting healthy eating and exercise, many public health experts hope for the strongest guidelines science could support. There was significant progress on child nutrition with the bipartisan Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. That act required school lunch nutrition to be consistent with the dietary guidelines, issued by the Department of Agriculture and Health and Human Services. Most studies found that students took to the healthier offerings, increasing consumption of entrees, fruits, and vegetables, and reducing food waste. The Obama-era USDA said that between 2008 and 2014, 3 million more students ate school breakfast. The 2015 Dietary Advisory Committee, Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, or DGAC, DGAC, appointed by Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, also offered hope. The committee clearly said Americans should be encouraged and guided to consume dietary patterns that are rich in vegetables, fruit, whole grains, seafood, legumes, and nuts, moderate in low and non-fat dairy products, and alcohol among adults, lower in red and processed meat, and low in sugar-sweetened foods and beverages and refined grains. The DGAC broke new ground by specifically saying that added sugar should be no more than 10% of daily intake. For emphasis, the committee said added sugars should be reduced in the diet and not replaced with low-calorie sweeteners, but rather with healthy options, such as water in place of sugar-sweetened beverages. Just as groundbreaking, the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee directly connected diet to environmental sustainability, noting that the global production of food accounts for 80% of deforestation, more than 70% of fresh water use, and up to 30% of human-generated greenhouse gas emissions. Creative, evidence-based strategies are needed to reverse those alarming trends, the committee said. After reviewing studies around the world, the committee found that a diet higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calories and animal-based foods is more health-promoting and is associated with less environmental impact than is the current U.S. diet. But, at the end of the day, the advisory committee is only that, advisory. Once the DGAC report was submitted to USDA and HHS, lobbyists ate away at it like carpenter ants to downplay the relationships between meat and sustainability, as well as soda and obesity. Karen Perry Stillerman of the Union of Concerned Scientists wrote that during the two-year process that produced the 2015 guidelines, food and beverage companies and trade associations spent more than $77 million lobbying Congress. Of that, the meat industry spent $4.5 million, and the soda industry spent nearly $24 million. Scores of congressional Republicans wrote to Vilsack and HA Secretary Sylvia Burwell to say the committee wrongly vilified red meat and ignored the alleged benefits of lean meat. They said that the committee had no business injecting sustainability into the guidelines. The signatories collectively received $3.1 million in contributions from agribusiness from 2013 through 2014, according to the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Republicans responded with an Appropriations Act that banned sustainability from the guidelines and limited the scope of funding to nutritional and dietary information. In a press release, even before the act was passed, Vilsack and Burwell capitulated on environment and sustainability. When the final guidelines were issued, there was nothing specific about cutting consumption of red meat and processed meat, which are linked to cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. In 2015, the World Health Organization classified processed meat as carcinogenic and red meat as probably carcinogenic to humans. The final guidelines did keep the committee's recommendation for Americans to reduce added sugar intake to 10% of calories, but there were no concrete top-line examples or explanations in the executive summary. Buried in the guidelines was this data point. Sugary beverages account for nearly half of added sugars, and added sugars account for 270 calories, or more than 13% of calories per day. The too few details on soda disappointed the 2015 Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee members, such as Frank Hugh of Harvard School of Public Health. Studies overwhelmingly link sugar-sweetened beverages to obesity, while Centers for Disease Control and Prevention mapping showed a clear correlation between soda consumption and obesity. Hugh also lamented that the deep sixing of environmental sustainability was a hugely missed opportunity to educate the public about the environmental impact of their food choices and to create a food system that is more sustainable and conducive to the health of both humans and the planet. Hugh directly blamed political pressure from Congress and the meat industry. Sarah Reinhart, USC's lead analyst of food systems and health, estimated that if the USDA and HHS published guidelines on processed meat and added sugar alone, it would save 3,900 lives a year and $1.5 billion in medical costs from colorectal cancer and 19,000 lives and $16 billion in healthcare costs from type 2 diabetes. Helping people eat enough of fruit and vegetables could have saved 110,000 more lives and $32 billion in health costs. Other estimates detail the current toll of our politically manipulated malnourishment. In 2017, a 2017 study by an economist at the Federal Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and researchers from Cornell and Lehigh Universities found that the nation's share of healthcare costs spent on treating obese adults rose from 20.6% in 2005 to 28.2% in 2013. The total cost to treat adults for obesity-related illnesses rose from $212.4 billion in 2005 to $342 billion in 2013. Amid the spiraling overall costs of healthcare, a 2018 Milken Institute report updated the direct chronic disease costs of obesity and overweight to $480.7 billion in 2016, with further indirect costs of $1.24 trillion because of lost economic productivity and total chronic disease costs of $1.72 trillion, which equals 9.3% of the U.S. gross domestic product. The report said combating those trends requires a societal consensus in favor of healthful eating and exercise. A 2017 study by Tufts University, the University of Cambridge, and Montefiore Medical Center in New York City estimated that poor diet was associated with nearly 320,000 deaths from heart disease, stroke, or type 2 diabetes in 2012. The highest proportion of those deaths were related to excess sodium intake, insufficient intake of nuts and seeds, high intake of processed meats, and low intake of seafood omega-3 fats. Put another way, the number of American lives lost in just 1 year involving poor diets exceeds the 291,000 American combat deaths in World War II. A Lancet Commission study published earlier this year said, unhealthy diets pose a greater risk to morbidity and mortality than does unsafe sex and alcohol, drug, and tobacco use combined. The Republican Party is literally supported by red meat. The meat processing industry has given 79% of its nearly $17 million in contributions since 1990 to Republican congressional candidates, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. In the 2018 election cycle, the top eight contributors to congressional candidates from the food and beverage industry included the National Restaurant Association, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Wendy's, the National Confectioners Association, the Candy Lobby, and Bloomin' Brands, the parent company of Outback Steakhouse and several other restaurants. Nearly 72% of the $5 million they gave went to Republican campaigns. Republicans receive 100% of contributions from the parent companies of Pizza Hut, Wendy's, and Taco Bell, 97% from Waffle House, 93% from Burger King Franchisee Association, 92% from the KFC Franchisee Association, and 66% from the American Beverage Association. We will soon see if this lopsided support bears fruit, even if fresh fruit is appallingly scarce at most of the above entities. Under Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue, who is trying to roll back nutritional requirements for school meals, in a bizarre crusade against whole grain and lower sodium foods, he has claimed kids aren't eating the food and it's ending up in the trash. But his own USDA researchers produced a report this year that in effect debunked his tirades. The report found the opposite. The more nutritious the meal, the more popular those meals were with the students. The process of issuing the 2020 Dietary Guidelines starts with the 20-member 2020 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, picked by Perdue and HHS Secretary Alex Azar. The committee was announced in February. The administration kept the full list of nominees and nominations secret until June, when Politico was given a copy obtained under the Freedom of Information Act by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, which advocates for plant-based diets. On paper, the committee looks balanced, with 9 of the 20 members having been nominated by the American Society for Nutrition. The mission of the Nutrition Society is to, quote, improve health around the world through high-quality science-based nutrition knowledge, engagement, and influence, end of quote. But financial influence within the organization has been highly controversial in recent years, with 32 corporations listed as sustaining partners, contributing at least $10,000 to the group. The sponsors include Kellogg, Pepsi, General Mills, Mars, Nestle's, Mondelez, Monsanto, Cargill, DuPont, Pfizer, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, the Sugar Association, and the National Dairy Council. Tied for second place in getting nominees onto the panel were the Grocery Manufacturers Association, consumer goods and food giant Unilever, the International Life Sciences Institute, ILSI, and the International Food Information Council, IFIC. Each claimed 3 spots. Most nominees had multiple nominations. The American Beverage Association, the Academy of Nutrition and Diabetics, and SNAC International, the Global Trade Association for the Snack Food Industry, each placed 2 nominees on the committee. In all, 15 of the 20 advisory committee members have direct industry ties or nominations from industry-supported groups or glowing public praise from industry-backed groups. It is normal to have this level of industry presence on the nation's most important food panel, whether the administration is Democratic or Republican, since it has become increasingly harder to be a food scientist without industry funding. According to 2019 USDA data, after the early 2000s, public funding for agricultural research and development was put on a starvation diet. Meanwhile, private funding mushroomed to about $12 billion in 2014. The private-to-public funding disparity had former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Dan Glickman and former FDA Commissioner David Kessler calling for a new Federal Nutrition Institute in a February New York Times op-ed, noting that obesity has become the top disqualifier for military service. They pointed out that a nation that spends $40 billion a year on candy and hundreds of billions of dollars on health care related to obesity must spend more than $1.5 billion currently spent on studying nutrition. Establishing a place to research nutrition is also crucial to retain American competitiveness, they wrote. Despite Purdue's pledge to have professionalism on either end of the spectrum, both from the plant-based and meat-based side of the equation, making recommendations, academics and public health groups without industry connections are in the minority. Purdue and Azar send an ominous message when SNAC can snag 2 spots on the committee while the American Public Health Association is shut out. While the interests of SNAC, the grocery manufacturers, Unilever, and the American Beverage Association are fairly predictable to protect the profits of many of their unhealthy or marginally healthy products, the best understanding of industry's web around scientists comes through the innocuously named International Life Sciences Institute and the International Food Information Council Foundation. ILSI claims a quarter of the new Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee members. It nominated the chair of the committee. It also nominated the vice chair. ILSA North America says it, quote, advances food safety nutrition science for the benefit of public health, end of quote. But that claim is gutted by the fact that it was created in 1978 by a Coca-Cola executive to, quote, to unite the food industry, end of quote, in what proved to be manipulation of science and government health recommendations for its now more than 36 corporate members. Most of the above-named sustaining partners of the American Society for Nutrition are also members of ILSA, plus Hershey, Archer Daniels Midland, Campbell Soup, Kraft Heinz, Red Bull, Keurig Dr. Pepper, Ocean Spray, and Welch's. Another example of the industry's manipulation of research is an ILSA-funded study that made its way into the Annals of Internal Medicine in 2017. It said sugar intake guidelines are based on, quote, low-quality evidence and are thus untrustworthy. and an investigation this year for the British Medical Journal and the Journal of Public Health Policy by Susan Greinhalg of Harvard found that ILSA helped redirect Chinese chronic disease science from a paradigm that focused on diet to Koch's narrative, debunked by most public health experts, that blames lack of exercise instead of sugary drinks for obesity. Overweight and obesity in China doubled from 20.5% of adults in 1991 to 42.3% in 2011. Meanwhile, the journal Globalization and Health has just published a report on ILSA's resistance to any public health measures to reduce sugar consumption and efforts to downplay the dangers of glyphosate-based pesticides such as Monsanto's Roundup. Cancer-stricken plaintiffs who use Roundup have begun winning multi-million dollar judgments in the United States. The report concluded that ILSA should be regarded as a lobby group and that academics and researchers, policymakers, the media, and public should view ILSA's research as promoting the interests of the food, beverage, supplement, and agrochemical industries, while its actions promote its members' interests and counter healthy public policies. Potential industry influence will also permeate a new area in the 2020 guidelines, recommendations for pregnant women and children from birth to 24 months. One major recommendation in these new guidelines should mirror the guidance of the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization, namely that babies ideally should be breastfed their first 6 months for maximum nutrition. But the Trump administration shocked the pediatric world last year by at first refusing to sign what should have been a perfunctory United Nations resolution encouraging breastfeeding and urging countries to end inappropriate promotion of foods for infants and young children. The U.S. signed on after the language to end inappropriate marketing was removed. This move raises a legitimate concern that either the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee or the administration will shape the final guidelines to somehow extol the virtues of corporate infant formulas. Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee member Sharon Donovan has been a consultant to infant formula makers Mead Johnson, Abbott Nutrition, and Pfizer. She has conducted Mead Johnson-funded research and edited informational materials for that company. Also on the committee is Stephen Himesfield of Louisiana State University, who has served on the scientific advisory board of weight loss product Metafast. It is interesting that USDA and HHS essentially gave two spots to food replacement specialists when a 2015 study by Johns Hopkins University researchers found that very few commercial weight loss programs, with the exception of Weight Watchers and Jenny Craig, demonstrate long-term benefits. A study found that any short-term benefits of Optifast and Metafast attenuated after 6 months. And in another twist, Himesfield is also the 2018-2019 president of the Obesity Society. That society boasts five members to the Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee. The Obesity Society is already under fire from critics for accepting corporate funding from Coca-Cola and PepsiCo, and having once staged engagement councils with members representing PepsiCo, Monsanto, Nestle, Dr. Pepper, Atkins, Mars, and Campbell's Soup. Last year, Pepsi underwrote a special issue of the Society's research journal titled Low-Calorie Sweeteners and Weight Management. The Society vigorously denies that industry support is connected to its casting doubt on the efficacy of taxing sugar-sweetened beverages. Taxation has clearly cut tobacco consumption, and a federally funded study last year said soda taxes look promising in combating obesity. The effectiveness would likely depend on the level of taxation. And that brings us back to meat, that source of intense debate in 2015. The 2020 panel has several members with meat industry connections. Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee members Davis and Leedy have advised or spoken at protein summits meant to explore the misperceptions that Americans overconsume protein. The summits have been sponsored by the National Pork Board, the Beef Checkoff, the Egg Nutrition Center, Hillshire Brands, and the Dairy Research Institute, and the Global Dairy Platform. Another Dietary Guideline Advisory Committee member, Lydia Bazzano of Tulane, was nominated by Atkins Nutritionals, known for its low-carbohydrate, meat-focused diet. In another study funded by the National Pork Board, Leedy found long-term health benefits of pork-based breakfasts in adolescents. The comparison group was low-hanging fruit for improvements, adolescents who skip breakfast. Unabashedly, the Pork Board, which is hardly rushing to compare pork with fruit-based breakfasts, proclaiming high-quality lean pork to be, quote, a key component of daily healthy eating. Trumping up the health benefits of the other white meat is a Trojan horse for the pork industry to pig out on sales of bacon. While the average American family buys fresh pork, such as tenderloin, shoulder, roast, or ribs, just 6 times a year, the number of Americans who consume at least 3 pounds of bacon a year rose by nearly 50% from 2011 to 2018, from 44 million to 63 million. The Wall Street Journal noted in 2017, with the rise of low-carb, high-protein diets, fatty bacon made a comeback. If the Trump administration lays a heavy hand on either the committee or the final recommendations, there seems little chance for proponents of healthy diets to stage a comeback. The Union of Concerned Scientists has reported on how Purdue has stacked the USDA with executives and lobbyists from the world of pesticides, corn syrup, and junk food, and sided with big pork over small farmers and big dairy and others over children in the relaxing of rules on school lunches. Purdue's creation of an industry echo chamber has been so discouraging that employees at the top research arm of the USDA, the Economic Research Service, and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture have quit in massive numbers. Under the Obama administration, the two agencies together employed 700 people. That number is reportedly down to 450 amid attempts by Trump to slash their funding by half, and Purdue's plan to move the Economic Research Service and the National Institute for Food and Agriculture out of Washington into USDA's Kansas City region. That is on top of a move in 2017 to eliminate the USDA's Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion as a standalone scientific division and merge it with the Food and Nutrition Service. Critics say the move renders them more vulnerable to industry-influenced politics. Purdue's claim that he is making the move to save money and move scientists closer to agribusiness, quote, stakeholders, has been assailed by critics who see the move as divorcing USDA scientists and economists from collaboration with those from other cabinet agencies. In a Washington Post op-ed in June, two former chief scientists at the USDA, one under Obama and another under George W. Bush, wrote, "Food and agriculture in the United States face perennial challenges from a multitude of sources, pests, diseases, drought, flooding, brutally competitive markets, and trade disputes. It is disheartening to think that the science underpinning these vital contributions to the U.S. economy and the health and well-being of every American is under threat from the very government department overseeing them. When chief scientists, particularly one who served under Bush, are this concerned about a deck stack against their colleagues, one can only hope that the scientists at Purdue and Azar have picked for the 2020 Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee can be objective. The 2015 committee, with major backing behind the scenes by many career researchers in USDA and HHS, who were on teams for data analysis and nutrition evidence, certainly displayed such independence. Regardless of their industry connections, that committee knew that the health and well-being of every American was at stake. In a nation that loses more people every year to unhealthy diets than the total of American combat deaths during World War II, the 2015 committee delivered findings that industry did not want to hear. A diligent 2020 committee will almost assuredly deliver findings that this particular administration probably does not want to hear. While serving junk food to Clemson's football team might have been a joke, destroying a nation's health is not." Well, what strikes me about this article is, in fact, we do have the Cheeto president, and the Cheeto has been touted as the, quote, perfect junk food. The science behind the Cheeto goes down to even figuring out the exact crunch that people find delightful, and that it dissolves in your mouth and down to almost nothing. So basically, your body doesn't even have a way to measure that it's eating food, so it just keeps eating and eating and eating. How about let's not have the U.S. 2020 Dietary Guidelines short-sighted and brought to you by the Cheeto president? Okay, enough about our Cheeto addictions. Let's end the show with a little update on the opioid epidemic here in Ohio. This from the Columbus Dispatch. "Ohio drug deaths plunged 22% in 2018, but rise in Franklin County. Fatal drug overdoses dropped more than 22% in Ohio last year, the first decline since 2009, and a sign that the state may be turning the corner in a decade-old drug epidemic. But Franklin County bucked the trend, logging 476 drug deaths last year, the largest toll in the state, and up 10% from 2017. Ohio's decrease was more than four times the national decline of 5%, according to provisional data released separately by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Ohio had the third largest drop among states, but still had among the highest rates of fatal drug overdoses in the country. State data shows that most of Ohio's six large urban areas had double-digit declines, led by hard-hit Montgomery County, where drug overdoses fell 47% in 2018. Summit County reported a 46% decline. Other than Franklin County, the only urban area to report a jump? Lucas County, where deaths increased 8% in 2018. Cuyahoga County, which led the state in 2017 with 598 deaths, reported a 26% decline in 2018. Likewise, fatal overdoses in Hamilton County fell 20% last year. Montgomery County's turnaround from having one of the highest overdose death rates in the U.S. was so stunning that Dayton was featured by the Center for American Progress as an example for the country. What Dayton has done is remarkable, Ed Chung, vice president for the center's criminal justice reform effort, said when the report was released. Chung grew up in the Dayton suburbs. Dayton has shown that the opioid crisis is not hopeless, and that there are actionable steps that cities can take to reduce deaths and help people along a path to recovery. Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley said, "The big thing is it's stigma busting. So you need to use the bully pulpit to break the stigma around addiction issues and treat addiction like the disease it is. That is really important." Having police and recovering addicts work alongside social workers has proved greatly effective, she said. "I'm a big fan of peer advocates because that person's been through the walk. They're not just do-gooders. There's someone that has been there." In Franklin County and across Ohio, powerful fentanyl continues to be the leading cause of drug deaths, accounting for 73% of fatal overdoses in 2018, but it could be losing its grip. Statewide, the number of deaths attributed to the synthetic opioid fell for the first time in a decade. The state data shows other encouraging signs. Heroin deaths declined for the first time in more than a decade, falling 21% from the previous year. Cocaine-related deaths were down 29%. Fewer Ohioans are dying from prescription opioids, which are blamed for triggering the epidemic and serving as a gateway to fentanyl and heroin use. Fatal overdoses from prescription opioids fell 37% from 2017. Okay, well, folks, that does it for our show today. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's wakt@toppun.com, toppun.com. Also, if you'd like to review this show or any earlier show, please feel free to go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always." And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.